On this episode of Skeptico, Alex talks with Sigmund Freud scholar, Professor Todd Dufresne of Lakehead University in Canada.
What would that look like if any intellectual academic figure of our time was known to have done those things?
The problem is, yeah, Alex, is that there's hardly almost even any modern equivalent to Freud, because what Freud got away with for so long, which is essentially passing off incomplete results or fraudulent results as the truth. But he did all the things that you say he did. He manufactured evidence, and even the evidence that he had that he may have felt legitimately and honestly is so shot through with epistemological problems, because there's the contamination of results by the expectations he had on the patients. This, we know this, it's called suggestion, right? So we're already in Freud's life in the presence of a kind of cult.
Stay with us for Skeptico.
Welcome to Skeptico, where we explore controversial science with leading researchers, thinkers, and their critics. I'm your host, Alex Sakaris, and on this episode, we dive into the world of Sigmund Freud, as you just heard. This show, along with the previous show on global warming, are two shows that I think go together in some important ways. They're both shows that I've been wanting to do for the longest time, and I'm really glad that I've finally gotten them out. So if last week's show on global warming was really about the illusion of control that we create and that we allow science to create for us, then this episode is about how that illusion of control is sometimes deliberately manipulated in order to lead us in a certain direction. I think that's the only conclusion someone can come to when they look at the unbelievable case of the science, if you will, of Sigmund Freud, and really dig into the true biography, the true history of what went on, how the science was manipulated, how it continues to be distorted and manipulated, and how this shadow still lingers in our psychological background. Dr. Todd Dufresne was a great guest. I think you'll enjoy what he has to say. And one other thing, before I get to that interview, I recently received an email from David Metcalf, who along with Craig Weiler has arranged a very interesting webinar series through the folks at Reality Sandwich that digs into psi in an interesting way with a lineup of some very impressive guests. So I got David on the phone very briefly just to tell you more about this webinar in case you're interested. Here's David.
Thanks, Alex. Yeah, we've got an upcoming webinar, six sessions hosted by Craig Weiler and myself. And Craig's one of the folks that was really took on TED during the time that there was that controversy with Rupert Sheldrake and Graham Hancock's speech. We've got some of the leading lights of parapsychology coming in for a webinar. We've got James Carpenter, Julie Beischel, Dan Booth Cohen, Chris Carter, William Bankston. And we're really hoping to get a good conversation together around the issues of parapsychology and anomalistic science. And this is an opportunity for folks to come on and actually, you know, have a conversation with these people and really get in depth with it.
Okay, so if you want to check that out, I'll have a link in the show notes. Please do. Looks like a good series. But now let's get back to today's interview with Dr. Todd Dufresne on Sigmund Freud. Today we welcome Dr. Todd Dufresne to Skeptico. Dr. Dufresne is a social and cultural theorist best known for his work on Sigmund Freud and the history of psychoanalysis. He's a professor of philosophy at Lakehead University in Thunder Bay, Ontario, and the author of several fascinating books on this topic. I'll give you a couple of them. One is titled Killing Freud, 20th Century Culture and the Death of Psychoanalysis. Another that I dipped into as in preparing for this interview is Tales from the Freudian Crypt, The Death Drive in Text and Context. Interesting twists in that one as well. So with that, welcome to Skeptico. Todd, thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Alex.
You know where I thought we might start? We have a lot of ground I'd like to cover. Hopefully we can do a good job of covering it all, but can you tell us a little bit about your basic bio, your background, and then maybe lead into your interest in Freud from a research perspective?
Sure, happy to do that. Well, I mean, I guess I kind of came to Freud accidentally. my background is I did a BA in philosophy at a university called Western in London, Ontario. And at Western, I really discovered and was interested in post-structuralism, actually. So after my undergraduate, I went off to an interesting program at York University in Toronto called Social and Political Thought, where I did my master's and PhD there. And while I was there, in some ways, I went there with the intention of studying deconstruction, which I suppose you could say is a literary theory. But for philosophers, of course, it's a philosophical idea. And Jacques Derrida, the founder of deconstruction, of course, is a philosopher. So I went there to study deconstruction, honestly. And what I realized pretty quickly is that if I was going to study deconstruction, I needed to study not just deconstruction, because really it's parasitical upon whatever it's analyzing. So I needed to study deconstruction and something. So it could be deconstruction in Plato, deconstruction in Rousseau. And I stuck on doing deconstruction and psychoanalysis because so many of my colleagues at York and in Toronto generally were deeply invested in psychoanalysis, which was a surprise to me, honestly.
Can I interject a couple things? One, why was it a surprise to you? And maybe before that, maybe back up and give folks Cliff Notes' version of deconstructionism, big picture view there.
Deconstruction is a theory. It's part of, it's, to me, it's the cutting edge of what is called post-structuralism, which is essentially what French philosophy was from, let's just say, 1968 through to the 80s. And I did my graduate work in the 80s, which is the, I guess, the period of sometimes called of high theory, which is to say a lot of people did work on French philosophy. Derrida and deconstruction, what it's really about is a critique of foundations and what is sometimes called, in a fancy way, essentialism. So theories of meaning which are essentialist, classic would be Platonism, the idea of the theory of the forms. The idea that there is an essential notion of truth, which only certain people have access to. And what you have with deconstructionists is a kind of a deep analysis of the assumptions of authority and ultimately of power that go into these theories.
So the Simpsons version of this, if you will, is just kind of the idea that everything is up for grabs in much more of a way than we've been led to believe, and that we've kind of bought into a system of education and culture that has some fundamental assumptions that need to be challenged and deconstructed. Is that maybe what Lisa would say? Or
I guess that's what Lisa would say. Critiquing authority and power. I mean, that would be the very, very shortest thing to say, usually at the level of text. How texts and how authors contradict themselves in their basic assumptions. That would be something that deconstructionists do. And I suppose when I was in my graduate school period, I was very much a committed deconstructionist. What happened to me, of course, which is kind of funny, is that so I was interested in deconstruction and doing work on that. But because I wanted to do a field that made sense as a site for deconstruction, what I had to do was learn something about Freud and psychoanalysis. Now, I had some exposure to it as an undergraduate, and so I wasn't completely cold on it, but I didn't know a whole lot. And because of the cultural interest in psychoanalysis in Toronto, it just made sense for me to look at it. Now, I think what you asked me is, why was I surprised deconstruction or psychoanalysis was so popular and important to my graduate school colleagues?
Exactly, right. Why?
Well, what's interesting in Ontario and Canada, where I was doing my graduate work, is that psychoanalysis was covered, and still is covered, as I understand it, by our healthcare plan. So many of my graduate school colleagues, many graduate students in general, would go into psychoanalysis, which was free, which was 4 or 5 days a week, 50-minute hours, and they would explore themselves, right? So it was, in some sense, people were doing it often, not just because they were neurotic students, but in that kind of pure sense that they wanted to explore themselves as artists, say, which you might say is like maybe what Woody Allen was trying to do with his many, many years of psychoanalysis. Not only would you maybe have some things you want to explore, some neurotic tics or whatever, but just because it maybe will make it easier for you to think creatively about the world around you, and et cetera, et cetera. It's the kind of thing, in other words, that people with excess time and money usually do.
Right.
In case in Toronto, it's because there's a huge psychoanalytic institute there. So there's a lot of psychoanalysts, and there's a huge number of students that are willing to take it up. So many of my colleagues were into it. And I just, I came from a fairly traditional conservative school, Western in London. where, you know, the idea that people were in psychoanalysis was completely foreign to me. And before that, I come from Northwestern Ontario, where, you know, I'm sure I knew about Freud, but not in any serious way, and certainly never heard of anybody that actually had been in analysis. So when I went to grad school, of course, I met many people that were in analysis, and I just thought it was very surprising to me. So that's how I got interested in Freud.
Okay, so that's how you got interested in it. And then once you got interested in it, you, like a lot of folks who have a kind of a fair-minded, just kind of open-ended research interest, find a lot of history that hasn't been adequately, I think, explored and explained, at least until recently. Can you take us through, maybe at a high level, the evolution of this Freud scholarship? What's emerged in the last 20 or 30 years in terms of who Freud really was? What's the story behind these murmurs we hear in the background that maybe Freud wasn't all he was cracked up to be?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'd back up just for one second and say this first to get into that. For myself, because I was interested in deconstruction, what happened to me is that when I looked at Freud, I realized that the work of deconstruction in psychoanalysis was not actually very good. So ironically, I ended up being somebody that was interested in deconstruction, but became a specialist in Freud. And my first self-authored book, The Tales from the Freudian Crypt that you mentioned, it ends essentially, before I start doing my own thing, with a critique of Derrida and deconstruction. So what I was left with was realizing the limitations of deconstruction and stuck with an area of study that I, in fact, never had any intention of being a specialist, which is Freud and psychoanalysis.
Wow, that is interesting, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm very, I suppose, unusual that I came to psychoanalysis, not because I was in analysis or because I particularly liked it, just purely because I was curious about it. So to follow up on the rest of your question, you know, the evolution of Freud scholarship, one of the things that really struck me pretty quickly, I got lucky in some ways because I was a TA for a guy named Paul Rosen, who's a major Freud scholar, and he was the main Freud scholar probably at York University, and he's one of the main biographers of Freud in the world, since passed away. And I happened to be set up with him to be his TA, which made sense given my interests. And what I really quickly realized is that in the field of psychoanalysis, there are certain texts and certain thinkers that are, you know, verboten, they're not allowed, right? And certain kind of thinkers that are not looked upon very well. And Rosen was one of these people. So to my great luck is that I worked with a guy that was already kind of a heretic in psychoanalysis. So I was immediately struck by how politicized the field was and how, you know, if you simply read somebody like Rosen's work or many other scholars who have been kind of on a list of heretics, you realize that there's lots of great work out there that many people simply won't read because it's been blacklisted one way or another. So what I had to realize is that I really had to find my own way, and that the field was really, this field of criticism in the last 30, 40 years was made possible by people like Paul Rosen, Henry Ellenberger, great historian as well. And then at the other end of that, Frank Chaffee, great philosopher, since passed away as well. And then at the other end, in the 90s, somebody like Frederick Cruz, who's an English professor from Berkeley, since retired. These people really, you know, had to have a certain amount of courage to go against everyday convictions about Freud and psychoanalysis, because like I said, certain criticisms of Freud, certain viewpoints of Freud were just not indulged at all. So for me, I didn't have to be brave in some ways. I already had the field was already opened up by these people who suffered the consequences of their heresy, I suppose. Rosen, who, you know, started off as a darling of the psychoanalytic field and became a heretic, he really suffered, I think, personally at the hands of institutional psychoanalysis, because he really wanted, I think, to be accepted in some ways. Well, for me, of course, I had no illusions. I never cared to be accepted by them. And I also had no problem reading works that people wouldn't read.
Before we talk past that too much, give people a sense for this criticism, because there are layers of criticism. And the way you're saying it, I think people might get the impression that there's kind of a little tussle over how this should be interpreted or that should be interpreted, when in fact, the real historical touch points that we have paint just a horrible picture of Freud, of someone who's really a complete fraud, who manufactures evidence in order to support his theory, that copies without attribution other people's work, or at least he promotes himself as kind of being this original great genius when, you know, he's really stood on the shoulders of all these other people. I mean, it's really the history of it beyond just critiquing theory is just, I think, stunning for people who haven't fully encountered it. And the other side of that, though, that I really want you to get into to support that is how we know that, how this information was really held in kind of lock and key and protected under tightest controls for so long. And then it's gradually, you know, they've pried it loose. So give people a sense for that.
Yeah, there's so much to say. I hardly know where to begin. In some ways, from my perspective, what really happened was Ernest Jones came out with this 3-volume biography in the 1950s, 53, 55, 57. Then he died. And basically you have everything after the Jones biography, which is an official biography of psychoanalysis, is kind of a response to this official biography. And what happens is that people start becoming more and more critical of psychoanalysis. For me, with Rosen is one of the first figures in this regard, and it's around 1967, 68 when he publishes a book called Brother Animal, in which he reveals that one of Freud's early followers committed suicide. You know, and Freud, I guess the radical side of this is that Freud was very unmoved by this follower's plight. He was sycophant, like half the people surrounding Freud, and he kind of rebuffed him in various ways, and the guy committed suicide. Okay, that's horrible. Not entirely surprising in some ways. What is, in fact, deeper and more radical than that is that Rosen exposed it during the 1920s, during two periods in the 1920s, Freud analyzed his own daughter, Anna, and that's what really got him into trouble. And that's kind of the beginning of this movement to reassess the fundamental myths of psychoanalysis, or the shibboleths, the things that we didn't know were myths, but certainly we now know our myths. And I call it really the beginning of critical Freud studies. I take it to be this is a post-Jones movement, roughly from mid-60s through to the late 1990s, and maybe going on to today as well. And I see it as like the whole purpose of scholarship in Freud studies is to move to critical Freud studies. Now, how did it happen? It's really amazing. One of the untold stories of psychoanalytic studies, or Freud studies, as it's usually called, is that one of the reasons there's so much misinformation is that the vast majority of books published and that appear under the library heading of BF 173 to 175, roughly. You can go to any library and you find all the Freud books there. This work is so much a shot through. Basically, most of this work is vanity publishing. So much of the field is run by psychoanalysts who have positions of authority. They start their own book publishers. They start their own journals. And pretty soon they have a kind of authority in the marketplace of ideas, so that it's very, very hard to actually find in the thousands of books I'm published on Freud. It's hard to find anything that actually tells the truth. So it's a very hard thing for somebody to free themselves from many, many misconceptions about Freud. And you mentioned a couple of them. Freud manufactured evidence. One of the things that's not well appreciated is how much, Freud went out of his way to manipulate the reception of his own work, right? He wrote his own histories, first of all. He always revised his own histories, and sometimes there's discrepancies with his own histories, but he was always trying to spin his history in advance, because Freud always kind of perceived himself as a historically important person. And so he proceeded accordingly. So he destroyed some of his correspondence. He would destroy his process notes that he used to create his famous case studies, of which there really is only 4 that he wrote, all of which are failures, by the way. And he destroyed the notes. These were important cases. You'd think you'd keep them, but he destroyed them. He tried to get his famous letters with Wilhelm Fliess destroyed, but Marie Bonaparte preserved them against his wishes. So Freud was always interested in manipulating the reception of his work. And he was largely successful in many ways, because people generally have believed what he said.
Can we stop sure. right there? Because one of the things I always like to do when I get into these discussions with people, and I have just kind of a very superficial understanding of this stuff, you know, you could get into it in much greater detail. But I always stop at this point and say, you know, what would that look like in modern academic standards? You know, just what we already know there. What would that look like if any intellectual academic figure of our time was known to have done those things? I mean, I can't imagine, but they would be completely ostracized is just kind of the beginning of it. I mean, they'd be a complete joke.
The problem is, Alex, is that there's hardly almost even any modern equivalent to Freud, because what Freud got away with for so long, which is essentially passing off incomplete results or fraudulent results as the truth. You know, I can give you some examples. We'll get into it maybe later. But he did all the things that you say he did. He manufactured evidence, and even the evidence that he had that he may have felt legitimately and honestly is so shot through with epistemological problems, because there's the contamination of results by the expectations he had on the patients. This we know. This is called suggestion, right? An undue influence. But you got to remember that this guy, one of the things that's interesting about Freud is he was a scientist, and as a scientist, he had followers. And these followers routinely referred to his major works like The Interpretation of Dreams as their Bibles. So we're already in Freud's life in the presence of a kind of cult or church, or I mean, it's something that's not scientific. I mean, this guy was a trained neurologist, right? And he asked some legitimate questions. He explored these questions, but at some point, ambition took over, and he fudged the results in many ways, like you're saying. So what would happen today is, of course, and what should happen with Freud is that the minute people see that he fudged the results in a number of ways that are absolutely clear, there's no question. Well, anybody that has any fair-mindedness would say that everything that follows from those results is therefore questionable.
Right.
But that's not what happens with Freud. And that's because we're in the presence of a belief system like a religion, so that people don't want to question it. You know, anything today, it'd be like this. You know, you lose tenure, you lose your job, you'd be fired. And when this happens, of course, people fall into disgrace. But Freud has never really seriously fallen into disgrace. And one of the things that's happened, which is amazing to me because I'm somebody who works in the humanities, is that really part of the blame belongs to people in the humanities and social sciences that don't really care about science or, in some ways, truth, not to be too general about it. And they don't care that maybe he fudged the results. They're just interested in this as a hermeneutic system, a way of interpreting the world. And so this is the place we get where people are really non-skeptical about Freud, and they don't want to hear it. You know, it's they do not want to hear it. And that's my colleagues, I'm afraid.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I think it'll be very interesting to a lot of our listeners, because I think that kind of theme comes up again and again on Skeptico, and that's that we all think that we're driven by data and evidence, and what we come to find out is that we aren't so much driven by data and evidence. We're driven by beliefs and values, right, and all sorts of strange ways that we protect ourselves. So now might be a good time to maybe give us a couple of examples of these obvious
lapses in judgment.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Give us some examples.
I'll start with we'll start at the beginning. The case of Anna O was a case that Freud and his colleague Joseph Breuer produced as Chapter 1 of Studies in Hysteria, and it was presented as the first successful cure of hysteria through talking. And so she's the one, Anna O, actually, her name was Bertha Pappenheim, who coined the phrase chimney sweeping and the talking cure. That's her invention, which was taken up by psychoanalysis. And it was presented as a cure, but in fact we know conclusively, with no question, and we've known it since 1972, that when Bertha Pappenheim finished with her analysis with Joseph Breuer, she in fact was put into a sanitarium where she was diagnosed as hysteric. And not only was she hysteric, she was also addicted to some drugs for a facial neuralgia, which wasn't even mentioned in the case study. The upshot of this is that we know that, and incidentally, Bertha Pappenheim in her later life always hated, we have records that she hated psychoanalysis. Well, of course she did, because she know they published a case in which she was presented as a hysteric who was cured by psychoanalysis when she knew perfectly well that she wasn't. But of course she couldn't come clean on it and say, by the way, I'm the hysteric that they're talking about, that crazy person, and they never did cure me. Mm-hmm. And you know why they didn't? Because I was still hysteric. You know, like, this is not something she could say. And Bertha Pappenheim became an important social worker and feminist in Germany. So this was not somebody who could say anything. And I think Freud and them knew that. And Mikhail Borg-Jacobson has written a really good book in which he basically says they banked on her silence. Okay, there's an example where they presented as the first cure somebody who literally, clearly was not cured. Mm-hmm. And really, that's how everything goes in the history of psychoanalysis. They present stuff that is completely untrue.
You know, another part of this history that I think folks might find interesting is later in his career. Can you talk a little bit about Freud publishing these psychoanalysis papers on public figures and celebrities that he had never even met? I mean, I just think that's extraordinary in our time. I mean, it's just laughable, but he really did try and pull this off.
Well, I mean, he did some analyses of Dostoevsky, who he'd never met. This is more of what Freud himself would almost admit as kind of like a wild psychoanalysis, but he indulged himself because he was a cultured guy and he was interested in a wide range of themes.
Right, but keep in mind what you said before. He's a scientist, right, who's proposing a theory, and he's built this whole enormous edifice of, consultants that are going out and making all this money. So, yeah, with that, I mean, what is he saying about folks?
Well, I mean, the funny thing is, I mean, yeah, he was a scientist, just to back up, he's a scientist, but he's heavily influenced by literature. And what he thought he was doing in some ways was making scientific the insights of poets and philosophers before him. So this is why he was so deeply interested in Shakespeare, who he couldn't believe was the actual author of those works. Or this is also why, on the other hand, he was interested in Nietzsche, but in a negative way. He would never cite Nietzsche and claim that he never read him, though we know conclusively that, in fact, he studied him in university and studied with people that knew lots about Nietzsche. So Freud is a kind of what he's trying to do is do the science of the unconscious. And the unconscious had a history that predated Freud, and he was going to make it scientific. So he's dealing with really the history of the humanities and social sciences in a way. And he was, a very smart guy. So he had a diverse set of interests that much outstripped the interests of his followers, who, like you say, were clinicians trying to make money off of a particular therapeutic, practice. But Freud, didn't just engage in therapeutic practice. He engaged in this theoretical sort of work, which is where he gets himself into all kinds of trouble. Now, why did he do that? Because in a way, Freud never wanted to be a therapist in the first place. Freud wanted to be a scientist. Freud wanted to be a research scientist in the university. Really, he wanted to be a professor. But that route was denied to him because he was a Jew. So faced with this anti-Semitism, Freud started, plus he got married, and they started having kids right away. Freud started a private practice. The necessities of a private practice are that you have to have patients. And Freud created a world for himself out of patients. No, I'm not going to state this. Freud had a private practice as a nerve doctor. He's trained as a neurologist, but he studied people's nerves, which we know has nothing to do with neurology. And he created his practice out of the detritus of the medical system, which is to say, people who suffered from hysteria and things like that were being ignored by the medical profession. So the good thing about Freud is he took serious psychosomatic complaints that everybody ignored before. That made him the first real psychotherapist. Mm-hmm. On the bad side of this is that he didn't really care about therapy. He cared about science. So what he did is he took the analytic couch as his laboratory. So Freud was constantly on the look for something that would make him well-known and respected as a scientist. And that's what's driving his findings and his manufacturing of findings, what's driving his claims about cocaine earlier on in his career, and then about childhood sexual abuse, and then about childhood sexual fantasy. This stuff is driven by his desire to be recognized, which is completely understandable and human, but that's what gets him into trouble. So your question was about this work where he branches off and does what I call kind of like a wild biographical studies. Dostoevsky and others, the best one of all is one that the psychoanalyst believed that he didn't even write, and it was only published in the 1980s. It's called Woodrow Wilson, a psychological study that he wrote with William Bullitt.
Yeah, yeah, that's one I've heard of, right?
It's hilarious.
Yeah.
Because it is so awful. And what's also great is that the psychoanalyst claimed that there's no way that Freud wrote that, that it must have been by William C. Bullitt and that it was a fraud. But we know that he did write it. Uh-huh. So that just it just shows you how much they wanted to distance themselves in the 1960s from what was obviously not just wild analysis, but bullshit through and through, right? Freud hated Woodrow Wilson. He also disliked, or possibly if you could say hated, Americans. But at the same time, needed the Americans because they were fueling his practice after the First World War, for sure. And he had many, many patients from America. So he needed their money. He had them pay them in American dollars. And but at the same time, really hated Americans. He's got some great line where he says, the problem with one American patient I had is that he had no unconscious. And that's the ultimate insult from Freud. And that says something, I think, about what he thinks about Americans in general. You know, cliches, no history, no unconscious, no depth. This is a European matter, right?
How does this idea that gets germinated here in the United States as it, you know, moves over of psychoanalysis and that we need to break through these barriers and all that, how does that work its way into and maybe tap into some cultural trends that are already in existence, right? Because it does have this kind of snowball effect. That's something you've done a nice job of kind of pulling apart. How does it hit those chords that we're already believing? What is it about psychoanalysis and about Freud's ideas that made us want to believe, that made us want to jump into it like that?
There's quite a bit of work done on it. In some ways, I suppose you could say it's a mystery how it is that this European theory about depth in history fits so well with American ideas, especially when Freud thought that America was the opposite of that. It wasn't about the unconscious, it was about the conscious. It wasn't about the id, it's about the ego, and so on. He said Americans are only interested in dollaria, and he attacked them very much. But somehow it caught on. For him, it was because it had to have been misunderstood, right? Because psychoanalysis is such a rebellious, revolutionary idea that if anybody immediately likes it, obviously they've misunderstood the radical import of it. Right. So that was his view. And this is why when it was picked up in France, they took it as a point of honor or pride that they resisted Freud for a very long time until really Lacan in the 1950s and the 1960s. So that's because they took it seriously, right? They resisted it and then understood it deeply. Mm-hmm. Americans took it on right away. And I think, like I said, some of the things about American individualism, this is about the psychoanalysis of one person, not looking at what the social and cultural determinants of your illness are, but what is it about your psychological makeup? What is it about your dreams? What are your freeze? It's really about the individual. So that fits with American sort of ideas. I think, leaping to one of the last things you said about politics, I think this is one of the keys to understanding why it is that criticism of Freud, that he's like a Teflon, God in the face of all this criticism. In America, in the English-speaking world, but especially in America, Freud really was the proponent of not free sex simply, not just the unconscious, but of a kind of liberal view of the world, a greater openness.
Right.
And this fit in not with everyone in America, of course, but with what we call nowadays the liberal elites living along the coasts, right? So all the big cities on the coasts, plus Chicago and some other places, these are the hotbeds of psychoanalytic interest. Why? Because these urbanites are sophisticated enough to understand that here finally is a philosopher / doctor scientist saying that it's okay to live freer, more carefree, individualistic lifestyles. So in that sense, it's good, right? Freud is on the side of the angels for liberals. So as soon as somebody attacks Freud, like me or my colleagues, that's why their first reaction is, well, you must be a neo-Nazi conservative right-wing crazy person. Right. Because if you're not...
Or have some kind of weird religious...
Exactly. It's not for intellectual reasons. Obviously, your politics have got to be bad if you're against Freud, because Freud is on the side of good, on the side of progress and progressiveness. Well... In a way, yes, he was, because that's how the American left received him. Great. That's why he made possible people like Herbert Marcuse and another crazy guy, Willem Reich, right, who was huge in the States for quite a while as well with his Oregon accelerators and all the rest of that. Freud made possible this stuff. So Freud is on the side of progressiveness. To go against him must be mean you're a conservative jerk. So that's happened still in France as well. That's how the French have received their critics too. You must be anti-Semites. You must be conservatives. How could you possibly criticize somebody who's on the side of progressive politics?
And at the same time, as you point out in this book, Tales from the Freudian Crypt, he's playing some notes that resonate with our religious traditions, our Abrahamic traditions, right? Of this death drive, of this apocalyptic kind of situation that we're in, right? I mean, it's kind of a very grim kind of message in some way that he's painting it in a much more subtle kind of way.
Yeah, that's true. It's funny you say that, though, because, you know, the funny thing about Freud's views of human nature, especially in the late work of Freud, is usually thought to be after 1920. So that's the work made possible by Beyond the Pleasure Principle, which is what I discuss in the book that you mentioned. And that's the work that everybody is actually familiar with, which is The Future of an Illusion and Civilization and Its Discontents. That is made possible by the late work. But what's interesting about that work, and it's funny that it's so popular in a way, is that this work is Freud's darkest work. His view of human nature is one, as you say, it's a grim view of human nature. Even in The Future of an Illusion, which seems like on the surface a anachronistic Enlightenment attack on religion, and so it's with the rationalists, still has in its conclusion very dark views about how humankind can only change over the geological time, the space of geological time. This guy does not. His more typical, obvious Freudian view of the world is civilization is discontents. We are discontented in civilization. So yeah, his view of religion, of course, religion is a infantile illusion, but society itself is something that represses the individual. And so the late Freud is this Freud that realizes that you can't escape that. There's no escaping the illness caused by being a member of society. There's no escape from being in society, and there's no cure for it.
Why do you think, Todd, and you've touched on this earlier, why can't we shake free of Freud? And in particular, why do folks in the liberal arts have such a hard time turning their back on Freud?
Well, you know what? There's a huge investment in ego, in time, in prestige. I don't, whatever word you can put into it, that people have invested a lot. Some people have, you know, I think I say this somewhere, you know, for some people to have written a book, a positive book review or a positive essay about Freud or a positive book, it's hard to back down from that. Or somebody who's been in analysis for, take your pick, 4 months or 4 years or 14 years. It's hard to say, you know what, man, that was a waste of time. How foolish I was. People double down when it comes to their core beliefs. And they don't want to say, you know, geez, man, was I ever had on that? Was I ever a fool? Nobody wants to say that. You want to say, well, you know what? There's something about it that's really interesting. And, you know, you're just, you're too dogmatic and you're prejudiced against it. I learned a lot about myself, blah, 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 blah. But, you know, geez, you learn a lot from yourself going to church on Sundays too. That doesn't mean that it's scientifically correct. It just means that it's, you know, it makes you feel good. You know, that there's no argument to be made on the level of science. Why did my humanities colleagues and social science colleagues hold on to it? I just think that the investment in it is too great. They don't know how to think with it without it. In addition, not to be as hard on them, after Freud became dominant in North American culture and influencing, editors and people who make movies in Hollywood, you have movies and books that are written according to the code of psychoanalysis. If you don't understand psychoanalysis, you can't understand major works of literature in the 20th century. You can't even understand movies. You can't even understand, at the very bottom of the pile, insider jokes about trains traveling through mountains, right? Everybody has a little chuckle when that happens in a movie because you know what that means. Oh, that's a code for sexual intercourse. You know, in order to understand the world that we live in the 20th century, you have to understand Freud because the world has adjusted itself to Freudian ideas. I mean at the level of its culture. So these people see lots of validation of Freud. You know, all you have to do is read D.M. Thomas's The White Hotel. How could you know that? How could you know anything about that work unless you knew something about Freud? Well, that's because D.M. Thomas is invested in Freud. So in order to understand it, you got to know something about Freud. So it's a circle. It's a hermeneutic circle, and people exist within it, and they can understand the world according to psychoanalysis, but that doesn't mean that it corresponds to the world in any realistic way, if you want to use that term.
Great. I love your line about we double down on our core beliefs. That's a good one. It reminds me of, what's that book? Fetzinger, when prophecy fails, you know. Mm. Remember that? He does this analysis of all these cult groups that are around these charismatic leaders that have this prophecy. And I think it's published back in the 50s or something. And what you'd expect is when the prophecy, you know, fails, that they'd all disband and go their separate ways. And of course, what happens is the opposite. That just re-galvanizes them towards some new prophecy or some new thing. And
exactly.
I like yours, though. Double down on our core beliefs. So, Todd, it's awesome. I really appreciate all this. Tell folks a little bit more about what you're doing. In our email exchange, you mentioned that, you know, you do continue to teach students on this topic, but maybe some of your research interests have kind of moved on past Freud. Is that true? And what are you doing these days?
Well, it's true. It's a good question. I'm like one of these people that invested a lot of time in Freud, but luckily I was on the critical side of things, so I can endlessly say things about Freud. But at some point, it becomes pointless to you're either talking to the converted people who already agree with you that Freud is problematic in some serious ways, or you're not ever talking to the people that need to read your work. I've almost had my say, you know, and I really should have already had my say, but I have. I'm editing a volume of Freud's Civilization and Its Discontents for a publisher. I've done two of these other ones before I did Beyond the Pleasure Principle and Future of an Illusion, so I promised them a third one. So I'll do that, and I'll finish this book I'm doing on the late Freud called All the Riddles of Life, Love, Friendship, Community, and the Late Sigmund Freud, and it'll be my last work on Freud. And I also think, you know, it's one of those ironic things. It'll also be easily my best work. It's one of those, I spend this much time doing work in it. I know what I'm doing in it, and now I have nothing more to say about it, but there you go. Now I'm moving on. I do work, I'm teaching a lot more and doing work in aesthetics. You know, I suppose a wannabe artist in some ways myself. I do photography and sculpture and various things on my own. So I'm going to do more work in aesthetics. I'm interested in film and philosophy because I think it as a field, it is absolutely awful. So I have something to say there. And I'm doing work on capitalism and globalization these days, so I figure within the next 10 years, I will have absolutely moved beyond Freud. And this interview, I suppose, will be one of the last times I ever talk about it as well.
Hey, that's great. We got your last word on Freud.
Yeah,
that's super.
Perfect.
Well, super. It's been great having you on again. Our guest is Dr. Todd Dufresne. Many books on Freud. Just go to Amazon and look for his name, and you'll find all that stuff, including this new one that he was just telling us about. Todd, thanks again so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Alex. It's a pleasure.
Okay, all that good?
Done?
Yeah, we're done.
Excellent.
Okay.
That was fun.
Yeah. I appreciate it. I think it was good. Touched on a lot of stuff we like to talk about here. So,
Is that what you're expecting?
Yeah. This is really good. So what I'll do is when it does come out, and I don't know, it might be a few weeks because I kind of got some scheduling things, but I'll definitely just send you the link, send you the transcript, and we'll be done.
I assume you put it out there as an audio file, right?
Yeah. So it's an audio file that's published on iTunes. You know, we have several thousand subscribers on iTunes and many thousands more that come to the website and get it. So, you know.
Well, I noticed that you have a good roster of people. You know, I had no problem doing it when I looked at the people that you've interviewed. You have some good people there. So anyway, good job.
Good. Well, I hope I hope people find it interesting, and I hope it works for you too. Maybe some of your students will have a chance to see a different side of you.
Well, I'm like I said, I'm teaching a Freud course next term, and if you give me the link, I'll send it to the students, and I'll definitely get it posted on my my homepage and stuff like that. Maybe some people will click in there and check it out.
All right, thanks again.
Thanks, Alex. Really appreciate it.
Thanks again to Dr. Todd Dufresne for joining me today on Skeptico. I don't really have a question per se to tee up from this interview, but I do look forward to the dialogue it might create. Over the years, I've kind of banged on the Freud drum a couple of times, and I've gotten an interesting reaction. Most people are unaware of this, which is certainly not surprising. I think there's been a real effort to downplay or completely ignore this part of what is now well-established history. But I think it's also one of those issues that really leaves people
scrambling in terms of their core beliefs about who they are, about how the world works, about how that little voice inside their head really works and what it's all about. So I'm hoping we can generate a good dialogue on this show because I am interested in hearing what you have to say. Of course, the place to connect with me is through the Skeptico Forum or through the comment section of the website. The website address, again, is Skeptico, SKEPTIKO.com. While you're there, you can also connect with me through Facebook or by the old-fashioned email where you can click and send me an email, and I try and respond to as many of those as I can. While you're at the website, be sure to check out all our previous shows. They're all there available for free download. Even have a new section of the website that makes it easy to just grab all the MP3 files and download as many as you'd care to listen to. So check that out if you haven't already seen it. So I have a number of interesting shows coming up. Some of them kind of stacked up a little bit. I apologize to my guests for not getting them out sooner, but holidays and family and all that stuff makes it hard on a podcaster. But we'll get caught up just as soon as we can. Until next time, take care and bye for now.